Blog Talk Radio.
And good evening. Welcome to another episode and edition of Quest Youth Radio, better known as Quest Community Vibrations. I go by the name of Dr. Richard Bombay, PhD of Musicology, the oldest, the boldest radio program now podcast, normally on 89.5 WSOU, now on Blog Talk Radio. Well, this evening, I'd like to say that lyrics, like poetry, have a message. History, like a diamond, shines clear to the truth. Words have meanings that we comprehend like definitions, creating a chain of events that we all can understand. Just pull back the curtain and see the contributions, and you will find our Quest moment. This evening, we're so happy that you are joining us to hear the different perspective of our diaspora. A Quest moment where we like to make waves is basically when we say a cornucopia of physics dictates that where there are vibrations, there must be a medium, and all vibrations possess a wave nature. You see, in our community, our art is in fact and in spirit the medium through which our airwaves travel. Where there is no medium, there are no vibrations. Welcome again to Quest Youth Radio. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce Walter Pierce, our student host. Good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Bay. Welcome to another edition of Quest Youth Radio, the best youth radio. And to kick off the show, I will be starting with diamonds. Now, history is like a diamond. Each prism represents the work of a group of people at a particular period of time. Look into the diamond and see the reflections of your past self, the pain of your mother, the choice of your father, and the blood of your ancestors. Look deeply, and you are bound to find yourself. And see, for today's diamond, I'll be talking about Ruby Bridges. In full, Ruby Neal Bridges, married name Ruby Bridges Hall, was born September 8, 1954, in Tylertown, Mississippi. American activist who became a symbol of civil rights movement and who was, at age six, the youngest of a group of African-American students to integrate schools in the American South. Bridges was the eldest of eight children, born into poverty in the state of Mississippi. When she was 4 years old, her family moved to New Orleans. 2 years later, a test was given to the city's African-American school children to determine in which students could enter all-white schools. Bridges passed the test and was selected for enrollment at the city's William France Elementary School. Her father was initially opposed to her attending an all-white school, but Bridges' mother convinced him to let Bridges enroll. Of the six African-American students designated to integrate the school, Bridges was the only one to enroll. On November 14, 1960, her first day, she was escorted to school by four federal marshals. Bridges spent an entire day in the principal's office as irate parents marched into the school to remove their children. On Bridges' second day, Barbara Henry from Boston began to teach her. The two worked together in an otherwise vacant classroom for an entire year. Every day, as the marshals escorted Bridges to school, they urged her to keep her eyes forward so that, though she could hear the insults and threats of the angry crowd, she will not have to see the racist remarks scrawled across the sign of livid faces of the protesters. Bridget's main confidants during this period were her teacher and Robert Coles, a renowned child psychologist who studied the reaction of young children towards the extreme stress or crisis. Toward the end of the year, the crowds began to thin, and by the following year, the school had enrolled several more black students. Bridges bravely inspired Norman Rockwell's painting, The Problem We All Live, in 1963, which depicts young Bridges walking to school between two sets of marshals, a racial epithet marking the wall behind them. Her story was also recounted in Cole's children's book, The Story of Ruby Bridges, in 1995, which has his conversations with her as its foundation. In 1993, she began working as a parent at France, which had by that time become an all-black school. Bridges also spoke about her youthful experience to a variety of groups around the country. Her memoir, Through My Eyes, was released in 1999. The same year, she established the Ruby Bridges Foundation, which used educational initiatives to promote tolerance and unity among school children. In 2009, she published the children's book, Ruby Bridges Goes to School, My True Story. Thank you for listening. And just to sum up of why I picked Ruby Bridges this week, her birthday was actually yesterday, number one. So happy belated birthday to Ruby Bridges. And also, just to send a message to people who think these racial acts happened so long ago, you have to think about how old Ruby Bridges is. She's only 66 years old. This happened only about 60 years ago, which it feels so long ago, but she's still 66 years old. She's still out here helping, living a normal life. And, you know, it just shows the amount of hate a little girl received, one little black girl received, for just trying to go to school, which is crazy, and which helped her story actually led to other stories and other movements being formed to remove this segregation in schools, even though the movement, or I guess schools are not fully segregated, there's still segregated schools out there, and at least we made a huge effort into diversifying most schools in this country, and we're still making an effort for that to happen for a lot of children who either can't afford to go to private schools or prep schools, or just to diverse a lot of the schools in the country so that people could experience different cultures and different types of people that they won't see on a regular basis. So thank you for listening.
Well, one of the things, there are several things that you covered here, and I find it interesting that you look at the United States school system and the landscape, and you give an impression that the landscape has become diversified, when in fact, in your report, in your research that you delivered to us tonight, says that the school that she integrated is now all black. Do you remember that?
That's correct.
When we look into the microscope of public education in America, we find that segregation still exists. I see in most communities of black and brown people, the only students that you see attending are students who are pretty much black and brown. I say to you that desegregation while it was written into law, and here's a word that we spoke about before, somewhat de facto. In other words, the separation that was supposed to end, you know, didn't happen necessarily. I mean, in the state of New Jersey, we have some of the most segregated schools in the nation, but not mm-hmm. just in New Jersey. All right.
Right.
Whatever segments do you have for us today, tonight?
Well, to continue on the education part of today's show, I'll be concluding with Brown versus Board of Education. Now, Brown versus Board of Education, actually, May 17th, 1954, marks a defining moment in history of the United States. On that day, the Supreme Court declared the doctrine of separate but equal unconstitutional and handed LDF the most celebrated victory in its storied history. Although the Supreme Court's decision in Brown was ultimately unanimous, it occurred only after a hard-fought multi-year campaign to persuade all nine justices to overturn the separate but equal doctrine that their predecessors had endorsed in the court's infamous 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson decision. This campaign was conceived in the 1930s by Charles Hamilton Houston, the dean of Howard Law School, and brilliantly executed in a series of cases over the next two decades by a star pupil, Thurgood Marshall, who became LDF's first director counsel. When did Brown versus Board of Education start? Brown itself was not a single case, but rather a coordinated group of five lawsuits against school districts in Kansas, South Carolina, Delaware, Virginia, and the District of Columbia, starting in December of 1952. To litigate these cases, Marshall recruited the nation's best attorneys, including Robert Carter, Jack Greenberg, Constance Baker Mosley, Spotswood Robinson, Oliver Hill, Lewis Redding, Charles, and John Scott, Arnold R. Boulware, and many more. These LDF lawyers were assisted by a couple trusted and legal scholars, including future federal district courts Judges Lewis Pollock and Jack Weinstein, along with William Coleman, the first black person to serve as the Supreme Court's law clerk. In addition, LDF relied upon research by historians such as John Hope Franklin and an array of social science arguments. This research included psychologist Kenneth Clark's now famous doll experiment, which demonstrated the impact of segregation on black children. Clark found black children were led to believe that black dolls were inferior to white dolls and, by extension, that they were inferior to white peers. What happened in Brown versus Board of Education? After the five cases were heard together by the court in December of 1952, the outcome remained uncertain. The court ordered the parties to answer a series of questions about the specific intent of the congressmen and senators who framed the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and about the court's power to dismantle segregation. Then the court scheduled another oral argument in December of 1953. Wrapping up his presentation to the court in that second hearing, Marshall emphasized that segregation was rooted in the desire to keep the people who were formerly in slavery as near to the stage as is possible. Even with such powerful arguments from Marshall and other LDF attorneys, it took another 5 months for the newly appointed Chief Justice Earl Warren behind the scenes lobbying to yield a unanimous decision. The controversial nature of his decision the court waited another year to issue an order enforcing the decision in Brown 2. Even then, the court was unwilling to establish a firm timeline for dismantling segregation. It ruled only that public schools desegregate with all deliberate speed. Unfortunately, desegregation was neither deliberate nor speedy. In the face of fierce and often violent masses, resistance, LDF sued hundreds of school districts across the country to vindicate the promise of Brown. Who won Brown versus Board of Education? This is a complicated answer. Even today, the work of Brown is far from finished. Over 200 school desegregation cases remain open on federal court dockets. LDF alone has nearly 100 of these cases. Recent Supreme Court decisions have made it harder to achieve and maintain school desegregation. As a result of these developments and other factors, public school children are more racially isolated now than at any point in the past four decades. This backsliding makes it even more critical for LDF to continue defending the principles articulated in Brown and leading the ongoing struggle to provide an equal opportunity to learn for children in every one of our nation's classrooms. As then-Senator Obama observed in a 2008 speech in Philadelphia, segregated schools were and are inferior schools 50 years after Brown versus Board of Education. And the inferior education they provided then and now explains the pervasive achievement gap between today's black and white students. What was the impact of Brown versus Board of Education? The legal victory in Brown did not transform the country overnight, and work remains. But striking down segregation in nation's public schools provides a major catalyst for the civil rights movement, making possible advances in desegregation housing, public accommodation, and institutions of higher education. The decision gave hope to millions of Americans by permanently discrediting the legal rationale underpinning the racial caste system that has been endorsed or accepted by government at all levels since the end of the 19th century, and its impact has been felt by every American. Thank you for listening. Before you say something, Mr. Bay, I just want to recap of what I talked about. So, again, shout out to the NAACP, LDF, for helping me provide this article. And they basically just gave me a detailed explanation on the case and the procedures that were taken to actually kind of win this case. They explain also at the end that it's still complicated on who won, because there's still schools out there after the case that were still segregated and still included segregation. But they were working on that. But they believe, even though they didn't achieve this overnight, they still believe that they've made a huge enough impact to desegregate lots of schools than they thought of, and actually have a positive impact after this case was finished to millions of kids in this country, that education increased for a lot of minorities in this country, and they were able to actually choose what school they want to, besides going to a school that was only for their skin type. Thank you.
Okay, so, you know, let's just chop it up, you know, mano y mano. You're using a lot of terms, but let's just use some terms that everybody understands. Walter, do you believe schools have been desegregated in America?
I'm sorry, you broke up. Can you repeat the question again?
Do you believe that schools have been desegregated in America?
they all schools have not fully been segregated in this country as of yet. After the board, Brown versus Board of Education, of course, a lot of schools in this country started the desegregation process. But even today, there's still schools that are segregated. Even they won't say it. It's, of course, not going to say, oh, this school is only for white people or this school is only for black people. It's not, of course, going to say that. But you can honestly just tell by the admissions process and the people that actually attend that school if it's really segregated or not.
Right. Our perfect example is right here in New Jersey, where our court system found that the white districts in the state of New Jersey receiving better treatment, receiving more money than the inner city. And there was a Supreme Court decision in the state of New Jersey that found that that was indeed so. And so New Jersey was told that they had to, you know, do something about it. And so as a result, we're still working on that. So what did you learn from Ruby Bridges and Thurgood Marshall? What did you learn here?
First of all, they're both pioneers to this movement, and they're both prominent people that helped move this movement along and actually succeed at the end, complete the goals that it wanted to achieve. Ruby Bridges, you know, she was just a little girl in elementary school, just wanted to go to school, attend a school that had a pretty good education, and she's over here being escorted by marshals and people from the military as an elementary student. And you have people out here not attended the school that wanted to pull their kids over one student who did nothing wrong but just wanted to go to school. And little did she know, at the moment, she was actually inspiring a lot of other things that would follow, and she was one of the pioneers of this. And you also go to somebody like Thurgood Marshall, joined also along with this case to fight the case of Brown versus Board of Education, gaining all that type of experience and knowledge. He was then appointed to the as one of the first African American judges of the U.S. Supreme Court. So they're both pioneers. They're both people who contributed a lot to what I'm talking about today.
Yeah, well, we've come a long way, but we still have a long way to go. You may remember, I think it was back in June, we did a podcast where we featured, I particularly featured a family in Orange County, California. It was a Mexican family who had purchased a home from a Japanese family in California,
mm-hmm.
Orange County. And you may recall, you remember where I'm going? You see where I'm going with this? That particular story was one of the landmark cases that kind of set the tone for the desegregation case in America that Thurgood Marshall had up. But, of course, he worked with a number of people. And that Mexican family wanted their children to be able to attend, you know, a regular school. You know, I can visualize their children being dropped off, and I can still remember that story where the little girl is looking at the playground in the field, and it's so pristine and beautiful, and they walk up to the door, and they're told, oh, I'm sorry, no, this is not your school. Your school is further down the road. And as they walk further down the road to go to school, they walked and saw an old building with dilapidated fixtures around, no grass, no field, no playground. And, you know, the family got busy and went to work and said, no, my family, my children deserve the right to go to the same school as these white students. You know, and I just said it, now say it again. We've come a long way, but we have so far to still go. And by you bringing up these particular topics, it really accentuates that whole point of view and perspective. And, yes, I thank you very much. Good job. Now, I want to take the time to invite our introduce yourself and make a comment or ask a question or just say hello, okay? So we're going to start here with 6778. And good evening. Are you there on the line?
Yes, I am. Great show, as always. Great commentary. Keep up the good work, guys. You're doing a great job.
Thank you very much for your input. We're going to go to 7035 and ask you to make a comment, have a question, introduce yourself. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Okay. It's Valerie.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. Great show, Walter.
Okay. And that's going to be your comment?
That's it.
Okay. Well, that's fine. Thank you very much for listening in, calling in, and participating. Walter, I think that's going to be a wrap.
Yes, and I would like to thank everybody for tuning in to this week's edition of Quest Youth Radio, the best youth radio. You know, make sure y'all tune in on Saturday to our show Saturday morning at 8 o'clock to our hour-long show, which we give even more information we share to y'all. And if that sounds interesting to y'all, make sure y'all tune in. And again, Quest Youth Radio is the best youth radio.
And on that note, I would like to remind the audience once again that lyrics, like poetry, have a message. History, like a diamond, shines clear to the truth. And words have meaning that we all can comprehend. And we have definitions, and these definitions create a chain of events that we all can understand and help pull back the curtain and so that we can see the contributions of a people and find that quest moment that we've just experienced and have had this evening, a different perspective of our diaspora. Once again, student host Walter Pierce, excellent job. Audience and those of you who are listening, thank you for joining. And this is concluding another episode of Quest Youth Radio. Peace.